Hello again, this is Dolores Cannon with the Metaphysical Hour. We're going to be on here for another hour live, and we'll be speaking to a special guest tonight. But before we start, I want to give out the toll-free number. The number is 877-876-5227. 877-876-5227. For anyone who does want to call in, that number is toll-free all over the world. Okay, and my guest tonight is in Alaska, so we're calling all the way up there. And it's Baggage?
That's correct.
Okay, I always want to pronounce his name differently, and I didn't want to insult him. You scared me, because whenever we first called, we got the machine.
Oh, sorry about that. I just wasn't quite fast enough up the stairs to my office phone.
And I was thinking, oh, boy, it's happened one time before, and then I was left having to do the show and just wing it. And I thought, is it going to happen again or what? So she tried it again anyway. All right, Nick, but I think I've known you for quite a while.
Yeah, I think we met first time probably about 8 or 9 years ago, maybe even further back than that.
I think I met you right after your first book came out.
Well, that would have been about the middle 1990s, yeah, about maybe even 10 years ago.
Yeah. Okay, because I know I've met you several different conferences and things.
Yeah.
Sometimes we've even had a booth right next to each other.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, we end up in a lot of the same forums over the years, and it's always good to be connecting back with you again.
Yeah, because it always happens, you know, when you're on this circuit, you run into the same people over and over again.
That's right.
Well, I do know that Nick has a new book out, and we'll get to that. But first, I wanted to mostly cover tonight was the HARP Project.
Uh-huh.
Because, as I said, I think there's a lot of people that don't really know about it.
Yeah, you know, this our work on this goes back to the very beginnings. Back in 1995, I published with Gene Manning the book Angels Don't Play This Harp. And, you know, we've stayed up on the issue since. But essentially, it started out as an Air Force and Navy project here in Alaska and was in 2003 taken over by DARPA, which does a lot of the defense research that's kind of got applications across the disciplines, and a lot of the classified research gets done by DARPA.
Yeah.
But it's a field of antenna. There's actually 180 in the array now, which is our radio frequency antenna is about 70 feet tall. And when they are fired in a very specific way, they do something quite unusual. Instead of the radio frequency energy spreading out with distance, it actually gets concentrated into a form called cyclotron resonance, which is sort of this corkscrewing kind of motion that gets to a smaller and smaller area, so they're able to focus the energy and then be able to manipulate that energy for a number of weapons applications.
Well, I know I read the book right after it came out, and it was quite startling, but why don't you go ahead and give us your background first and how you first found out about this? It's like a secret weapon, really.
Yeah, it was, you know, I'd read actually, the first thing I'd read about HARP was in an Australian journal, Nexus Magazine, which is a great journal for those that haven't seen. It's got a lot of very interesting material, and it's usually very well documented. But I looked at this article, and I thought, you know, this is pretty wild, you know, pretty wild kind of project. And, I've been in Alaska all of my life. My family's been politically active here for a couple generations. And, you know, when we look at things going on within our own backyard, I didn't believe the article. And I went to the library, took a look at the sources that were cited, and sure enough, those things were out there. This is back in 1994. And then right after that, I collected maybe 20, 25 documents surrounding that issue after checking with environmental organizations, other groups that were not really keeping track of what was happening here, didn't really look at it from the same perspective that I was looking at it from, which was the energy coming off the ground, not so much the ground that was being disturbed. And as a result, I wrote an article that was published, and then Gene Manning contacted me, and we agreed to collaborate on the book. There was just a lot of information that needed to be told, and in the interim between the two of us, I think we collected 300-400 documents, and then there was another group, the NOHARP group up here in Alaska, that was Claire Zucker, Jim Roderick, and another guy here in Alaska that had kept a lot of records. And between all of us, we were able to put together at least, you know, what we could get from the open literature and an expose that became pretty well known all around the world. Actually, it was published in French and German, Japanese.
What we all remember it is that the government put this way out in the middle of nowhere, where you said there were only Eskimos living.
Well, it's essentially Athabascans in that region, but yeah, indigenous people to the region, and it's a very, you know, Alaska's a big place. It's 586,000 square miles. Mm-hmm. Only about 600,000 people live here, most of them in the urban areas. Where this is located, 250 miles northeast of Anchorage, it's
uh-huh.
pretty remote. Maybe a few dozen families within, you know, a 50-mile radius, so pretty small.
And it was almost like they did that on purpose so nobody would even know what was going on.
Right. That was one of the advantages. The other was Alaska happens to be, you know, the closest U.S. territory that has... that is the closest to where the magnetic field lines intersect the Earth. And part of the issue with HAARP was to actually pump energy into those magnetic field lines, use them as waveguides, where the energy would then transit instead of the normal flow, which is from the South Pole to the North Pole, the way the energy flows. It would actually corkscrew around each of those magnetic field lines, this energy produced from HAARP, going the other direction, so any, say, intercontinental ballistic missile or any other aircraft passing through that region would become disturbed, and it would blow their avionics, the things that control their flight paths. So as an anti-missile system, that was one of the original concepts with HAARP, actually.
That was what they said it was, the original one.
Right, but it's, you know, I mean, you think about it, it's like plugging right into your environment and literally changing its character in quite dramatic ways. And the magnetic field lines, it's interesting, is there was, you know, for guidance systems, more or less natural systems for birds, fish, migratory fish, and others to migrate, that's where the theory is today, that essentially they orient against these magnetic field lines. So when you disturb them,
mm-hmm.
you really have a huge environmental impact as well.
And I think you also said it would change the genetic structure, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, potentially you can really alter a lot of things when you start manipulating energy fields in this way. The other consideration was, there were a whole series of applications, depending on how they wanted to use it. They could use it in this way we just described. Another way was to affect a region called the ionosphere, which begins about 30 miles above the Earth's surface, extending a couple hundred miles beyond that. But by that area is highly energized, and you know, and if you can manipulate that energy in different ways, then you can do some pretty remarkable things. And one of those they discovered was they could send energy in and pulse the energy, or like almost like a punching action into the ionosphere, and the ionosphere would begin to mirror that pulse rate. So they, in for instance, in Europe, they played Wagner and got the ionosphere to literally move to Wagner. But in doing that, what they discovered is that they could convert the ionosphere into a huge transmitter using the system on the ground, almost like a little primer in the bullet or a trigger, to release larger amounts of energy in the ionosphere. And this is where the project takes on a whole nother turn in terms of what's possible when you can manipulate such a huge amount of energy that's a natural source of energy.
Well, that I know. I think from the book, whenever you began to find this out, though, you were really shocked that they were doing all of this, our own government.
Well, you know, the thing that surprised me is there hadn't been more concern raised. You know, then you think about it. You know, I mean, you don't really see radio frequency energy. It's not like an oil spill or a forest getting, you know, burnt to the ground. You know, things that are obvious from an environmental perspective. But when you think about radio frequency energy, you know, the natural background has radio frequency energy, and if you go back, say, a little over 100 years ago to just around the time that radio was discovered, before then versus today, there's 200 million times more radio frequency energy around us today because of what man has introduced. And yet, the human
We're dealing with the TV and all the other
microwave
and everything.
You bet. Microwave, radio, TV, and just the energy fields that emanate from modern electrical grids. I mean, if you take the whole spectrum in terms of what we've added into it, it's a pretty thick soup. And most people don't realize that you know, how much of an impact it has. Now, you can get some indication of this when you go, for instance, if you leave a big urban city like New York, for instance, and you go out to the country, you notice this feeling. In fact, a lot of people from big cities find it very uncomfortable. Like New Yorkers seem to always end up back in New York. You know, they don't feel good out there.
Well, it affects me the other way. When I go to New York, I don't want to be there.
Right. And if you're used to being in an environment that has nowhere near that kind of energy.
Yes, I live out in the middle of nowhere on top of a mountain.
And there you have it.
So, I don't like the energy of the people and the traffic. And the last time I went to New York was after 9/11. I came up out of Penn Station right onto Manhattan. I had to do a lecture there, and it felt like hitting a brick wall.
Well, you know, what happens in the city, and I think people who live in New York could attest to this, when the power grids fail, which is rare, but when they do in New York, what people always notice how quiet it is. But the second thing, if they stopped and thought about it, almost their whole body takes a big exhale, like you relax, because finally you're not having to compensate for all of these energy fields and their interactions that affects the body. It's almost like the same kind of phenomena that you're in a crowded room and everybody's talking, but you're carrying on your conversation, ignoring all the background noise. And that's what
we do. You know, even whenever you're in the mall or anywhere, I always sometimes feel like you're in the middle of a hive of bees.
Well, it's all
you can hear is all that sound, just like a hive of bees.
Yeah, but you know, even more behind that is really there's an awful lot going on, and I think that's where when you start to look at systems like HARP, and it's such a huge system, and its implications are pretty startling. And what we found in researching that issue is hundreds of documents showing why this system ought to at least have the scrutiny of more than just classified organizations of the military, and a few research arms looking at sort of theoretical ideas surrounding the ionosphere and its manipulation. And the ionosphere is extremely important for communication and the quality of communication. When the solar activity, for instance, is real high and it's disturbed, you know, you get satellite interference and all kinds of communication interference. You even get terrestrial interference on power grids. And if we could figure out, and this was sort of the beginning of HARP for many researchers, was if they could figure out how to stabilize the ionosphere during those times, then they could carry their communications. Or conversely, if they could disturb it in such a way where they could carry their communications but deny everybody else theirs, that was another military application. And I mean, we can see, you know, how military planners can think about it, but what we're concerned about in the very beginning and remain concerned is the idea of changing the character of something so fundamental to maintaining life on the planet without any more oversight than classified programs hidden behind government. And I don't think that's practical, whether we're doing it or in the case of this type of science. You have the Chinese engaged in it, U.S., NATO countries, the former Soviet Union, and others.
Mm-hmm.
And and now we're starting to see parliaments around the world starting to address this issue and be concerned about, you know, what are we doing with this kind of experimentation and what risks are we engaging in?
Yeah, I remember in your book you said whenever, I think you approached some of these military people and wondered, they don't even really know what they're doing, what they're involved with.
Well, and that's not unusual. I mean, everyone has sort of
a
snapshot view because we compartmentalize all of this military science where each expert gets to look at their piece of it. But they never really mix that much. And the few times they do mix, like in the beginning, they brought in a certain group of individuals, about 80 scientists in atmospheric physics, to put together the original contracts so they get some idea of, you know, what they wanted to do and bidding the projects and putting the science together. Once they did that and the academics were involved, then the programs start to get more narrow. And what you see is what is now run as campaigns, where just small groups from different agencies run their experiments for the various weapons applications, and then some of it just for plain theoretical understandings and increased understandings of the ionosphere.
I was thinking about, like, they didn't, like you were saying, they didn't even pay attention to the big picture, like what was it going to really do that it could really destroy the world.
Yeah, you know, and this is a couple of the independent scientists that worked with us. Brooks Agnew was one of them. He was an expert in earth-penetrating tomography, and what he was saying, and I think it still bears a lot of merit, is the idea of sending energy into the earth and looking at imaging, which he was doing years ago for some of the big oil companies, Halliburton in particular in terms of a drilling company, and he was showing that with like 99.9% accuracy, what he could find out using 30 watts of power, very, very little power, was as good as what they could find in their drill logs, including grade and quality of oil and the type of strata all the way down. And, you know, when you look at using the kind of energy that HARP is intended, which is an effective radiated power eventually of a billion watts, not 30 watts, the concern that Brooks had and others have had is that we might trigger an energetic release, an earthquake, or something worse. And, you know, and that's not so far fetched when you look at the Secretary of Defense, William Cohen. Back in 1997, he was lecturing on, it was actually a conference on terrorism and weapons of mass destruction and U.S. strategy. This is before 9/11, back in 97.
Yeah.
And he said, and I quote, "Others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism, whereby they can alter climate, set off earthquakes or volcanoes remotely to the use of electromagnetic waves," unquote.
I've written about this in my books, too.
You know, and
it's supposed to be prophecies of the future, like, you know, maybe it would never happen. And that's why when I read your book, they all kind of went together.
Right, because these technologies are now we have them. You know, I mean, it's not like you have to wait around for someone to do it to us. We can do it to ourselves.
See, if it makes sense that you could set off earthquakes if you're going to use that kind of power and the vibrations and the frequencies.
Right, because what happens is you set up resonances, harmonies, that then are greater than the sum of the energy entering. And so, first of all, you've got this instrument that's pretty big, I mean, in terms of effective radio power, what it's doing up there in the ionosphere. But even more importantly, one of the things Stanford discovered early on is that if you send energy into the ionosphere in the VLF, very low frequency range, within a certain window frequency, it triggers a release. It amplifies the signal 1,000 times. In other words, it catches energy that's already in the ionosphere and makes that signal 1,000 times more powerful. Now, when you start,
it magnifies it and multiplies it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's interesting in that it's you can get the same analogy of a primer on a bullet. You know, that the little explosion releases the gunpowder for the bigger explosion to take place. And it's the same kind of idea by analogy here. You have a system that acts in such a way as to take a big, powerful system fueled by the sun and the earth itself, and then manipulate that system for very specific uses. And that's, you know, when you start thinking about that kind of science, people should be concerned. You know, I know in there were some ideas for using this for weather modification as an example, and one of the big concerns that, you know, many people had. And then it was discovered several years later, because after HARP was completed, the European Space Agency contracted the inventor, Dr. Riesland, to do a study on use of HARP-type systems for weather modification. He completed that for them, and then FEMA and NASA hired him for doing a similar study but using space-based lasers to see if they could manipulate weather. And then...
You know, that's what everybody keeps talking about, the changes in the weather. I was wondering if you think it might be connected to that machine.
Well, you know, there's possibilities, but and I think there's no independent monitoring, which is a sad story. One of the things that we've expressed all over the world is this type of science needs to be monitored in a way that we do not take risks that are as big as the risks that maybe militaries would take when they can conceal a project and responsibility for any mistakes. And I'll give you a good example. When Dr. Riesland in 2005 was presenting at University of Pennsylvania, and he's a very responsible scientist. I want to say he's put in his papers now a lot of cautions to other scientists to consider, you know, what the activists are saying and to look across the disciplines, because, you know, he's learned a lot in doing that. And he discovered a way to modify weather using 1,600 times less energy than what HARP was intended to produce. Less energy. And so what he's concerned about, and he said it, is, you know, I'm not going to give this to the military. You know, this is, I don't have to. He developed it on his own. You know, it's his perspective. And if it's going to go anywhere, it's got to be done very, very carefully in the absolute open light of day with a whole lot of disciplines involved. But these are the capabilities are there. Other countries are going to develop these capabilities and launch them. And really, these technical discussions aren't happening in enough legislative bodies so that we make sure that whatever we do, if we do anything at all in some of these areas, we do it in the open light of day and in a way that doesn't place this planet at risk. And I don't think any country, individual country, should ever be in a position to place the rest of the planet at those kinds of risks.
Yes, and that was the strange thing about it. Here, if this is only one project that you were able to find out about, imagine how many other secret projects the government is doing that could be harming the planet.
Well, and that's true. And if you look at the environmental record on this, the biggest things that the Superfund has had to clean up are all related to government research. Not some, but all of the biggest ones are related to government research. And you know, and that's not to say that the research shouldn't happen. I think it should happen, but we ought to start paying more attention to the consequences than we have in the past, because as we get more sophisticated and powerful technologies, and technologies generally are doubling every 9 to 10 months across the board from the invention of the wheel to where we are today, figure a year from now to see that double again. You know, and every year
you don't even really know where we're headed. Everything is growing so fast.
Exactly. And so with technology, you know, what makes governments powerful in this century is really their command of technology. But when you start to look, and we have in the various books and publications we've put together over the years, when you start to look at the full implication of technology over this last decade and where it's headed, we're headed for a very different type of culture and society if we allow it to continue unchecked. And this isn't just talking about the environmental consequences, it's talking about personal privacy, surveillance-related technologies, how those have advanced, and where they're headed has caused an absolute need for open discussion about the very technologies that have been hidden from public view. And I think as if we ever open that box, there will be a spirit of revolution in every country on this planet in terms of changing our governments and making them more accountable, because virtually every government have abused the right of secrecy in ways that most, if you won't do it in front of your mother, you ought not to be doing it to your country. And that's what's happened way too much in terms of technology and development.
Well, I think that was one thing that whenever you started this, it came around at the right time because we had just gotten the internet going.
Yeah.
And a lot of yours was the information was spread over the internet, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, in fact, initially when we started, that was one of our considerations, was that there really wasn't ever the use of the internet in trying to raise awareness of this. And we're a pretty remote place. We utilized the internet, we utilized talk radio, we utilized every medium that was available to us. With the idea that if you could generate enough concern and discussion, that perhaps you could actually push forward change, and you didn't need to be some big organization or big entity to do it. You know, we did it. We used to joke about it. We said, a fistful of quarters in a phone booth, you can change the world today. And now you don't even need the fistful of quarters. You just need the phone booth.
That's true.
You know, and you're hooked into the world.
That was one thing. You were able to get this out before they could even stop you.
Yeah, and that was, we did that deliberately. You know, I come from a political family, as I mentioned, and, you know how to organize that kind of activity and what can possibly get in the way of it. So we were careful in that regard, and we self-published the book initially, and, you know, and since it's gone into translation, it's done extraordinarily well in getting the issue out, and it continues. The debate is not over. The Russian Duma in 2002 took an action against HARP. The European Parliament in 1998. This discussion is by far from over. We're seeing a little more discussion coming out of some of our traditional adversaries now are concerned with what's happening in this area. So, you know, I don't think that issue's resolved. Certainly it's not resolved at this point, and the risks do increase every year as they continue to increase the power here on this facility.
Well, I think that's why you were very instrumental in getting the word out and getting make people know about these things, because otherwise it's sitting up there in the middle of Alaska where nobody knows where it is. Nobody would have stumbled across it otherwise.
Yeah, that's probably pretty true. You know, I mean, there were people following it, but they were tired and they had kind of run out of things that they could think of that would stimulate the debate.
Uh-huh.
And the military kind of banks on that. They figure that, hey, these things will come and go. They last about 3 months and they go away. Well, We wrote the first article 12 years ago, and the issue's not gone away, and it continues to make progress,
yeah.
although slow.
Well, they probably figure nobody's going to believe them when they start out, too.
Well, you know, what we did, and we've done it ever since. I mean, in the four books we published, there's 1,650 source documents cited. And, you know, they're not, it's not our words, it's their own words, and it makes it pretty irrefutable. And I think that's become, for us at least, it's our hallmark. I mean, when people look at our research, and our research is quoted in legislators, by legislators and through legislatures around the world, because it's all footnoted. It's footnoted with the kind of material that people can get their teeth into and see clearly. It's not somebody speculating. It's the facts being put
yeah.
together in a way that you can look at them
yeah,
and make
that was one
decisions.
Of the things I liked about the book is that you were backing up your statements.
Yeah, and I think that's important. You know, I was always frustrated before I was a writer myself because I read a tremendous amount of material. You know, I read probably the equivalent of about 400 books a year, and and I always have, and over 48 years as an adult, say 40 of those years I read a lot of books. And you know, the thing is, when you start to look at how all this stuff ties together, the thing that's frustrating is when there's no source material, and the source material is what really validates what's being said. And I think to make change, if you're really interested in making change, you need to give people the tools so they can take it either to the scientist, politician, engineer, whoever, and they can scrutinize the material in a rational way and come to their own conclusion. I think that's the way things are going to change, and there's just not enough what I call technical reporters. And that's what I've always considered myself, not so much a scientist as a reporter on technology with enough of a generalist background to interpret it and call the right experts and get a clear understanding when I don't have it. And be able to bring that back out to the public in a way that's understandable. I think that's what we've tried to do, and hopefully that's happening, and we'll continue to do it for the foreseeable future on many of these issues.
Yeah, I always think it's important to do your homework, because I do a tremendous amount of research in my books, too, because I was always told you can tell if you do your homework, and you can also tell if you don't.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And there's plenty of material in the open literature. What we also know is, I mean, when you think about the kind of material we report on, what's in the open literature is a tremendous amount, and we know it's just the tip of the iceberg. And this is where we think we need to look at ways to make our system a little more accountable, because people want to blame usually the politician, but they're more ignorant than most of the people listening to this program.
Definitely, they say them and the president are like the last ones to know anything.
Well, and they're not scientists. You know, they're a different kind of person, and yet we need, and they're the ones who go into these closed meetings to deal with military research, and they don't even know the right questions to ask. Because to ask the right questions, you really have to have a little bit of background, and that's what's missing as these programs evolve. And then from administration to administration, you could put a bunch of scientists in the same room. They could exchange the state secrets with each other in front of a group of politicians who, as far as they are concerned, they could be talking Chinese.
They don't understand any of it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not to say that that's wrong. It's just to say we have to recognize that deficiency in national security debates as they occur in closed hearings without the right questions being asked. We have to figure out a different way to address some of this. And
I think that's why the politicians, when they find out these things are going on, they're shocked because they never knew it existed.
Exactly right. Here's what we found when we went to the European Parliament. We took and had a 5.5-hour meeting before the hearing with the with those committee members that were going to be sitting in that hearing, along with a couple members of the European media, and we went through all the documents, explained what they meant, so they would be able to formulate good questions, and they had the documents for months in advance.
Yeah.
And these were unclassified records, and then we took and demonstrated what's called an infrasound technology, sound technology that was only mentioned in the literature, and we were supposed to debate NATO on non-lethal weapons and on HAARP in the European Parliament. NATO refused to appear, saying they didn't have any policy on ionospheric modification, which is the stuff of HAARP, or anything on non-lethal weapons. And so we opened a hearing with a document called Ionospheric Modification for Weapons Applications by NATO France, an unclassified record. and a second document by the Strategic Studies Institute in London on the deployment of non-lethal weapons throughout NATO Europe. Now, at the end of 8 months after the hearing, they had a policy on non-lethal weapons, and they had egg on their faces relative to ionospheric experimentation, and they had essentially lied to one of the most important committees in the European Parliament. And, you know, that doesn't engender...
But you were saying non-lethal, but I've heard, I believe from your books, that it is lethal.
Yeah, and that's kind of, this is the interesting thing, too. In the hearings, the International Red Cross, that was on our side of the issue, said that the definition, according to the military at that time, for non-lethal weapons was anything that killed less than 25% of the time. Now, that includes, if you wanted to use that kind of ridiculous definition, that would include a Claiborne landmine, because it doesn't kill you usually, it just maims you. And this is the kind of logic that goes into these. And non-lethal weapons, whether it be gas, which kills dozens of people every year when it's used in with people with asthma or other lung disorders, people die all the time. It's a non-lethal weapon. Sticky foam, if you get it in your face, you suffocate slowly to death. It's a lethal weapon. If you get a rubber bullet in the wrong place, they're known to kill people. I mean, there is no non-lethal weapon. There's only a weapon that maybe isn't as the odds are lower, you know? I think that's the reality that has
come. Well, you might remember one thing in the book, too. You did talk about the migration of the birds and the animals and the changing of the genes, the genetic structure. But didn't you also say it was supposed to do something to the mind?
Right. And here's the thing that, and this really leads into the work that is the more recent work that we've been involved in. You know, we just finished the book, Controlling the Human Mind. It came out in late August and has actually just gone into its second printing.
And the one you just wrote?
Yep. It's Controlling the Human Mind. And this one.
Let's get into that anyway. So this does come. I remember you said, though, the waves off of HARP are supposed to scramble the brain or something, weren't they?
Well, what happens is, and this is according to research done by Persinger at Laurentian University, and what he showed is that manipulating the magnetic field lines of the planet, actually you could manipulate the behavior of human beings or their emotional state. And the way this works, according to Delgado at Yale, according to many researchers around the world, and we quote them within the book, but what they found is a frequency-following response, what they call an FFR, or what's referred to often as brain entrainment. It's where an external signal in certain window frequencies, certain ranges, can lock on, and the brain will lock on. Whether it's a flickering light in the optic through the optic nerve, you can lock on. If it's a binaural or bioral beat coming through sound in the ears or magnetic fields, as Persinger showed,
yeah,
the brain will lock onto those external signals and begin to copy them or mirror them. And if you know which ones relate to specific brain states, then you alter that individual's consciousness. And they've done this with humans and primates using radio frequency energy. And if you remember, earlier we were talking about how much of that's around us now, you know, 200 million times more than nature creates. What Delgado at Yale found is that if you manipulate radio frequency energy at 1/50th of what nature creates, in other words, 1/10 billionth of what man has surrounded us with, that very minute amount of energy in the right frequency and waveform, the body will pick it out of that soup of energy and respond to it. And with primates and humans, they were able to take them from the emotional states of aggressive to passive and back and forth, like flipping on and off a light switch. And
I'm just thinking the way you're saying that, it almost means the way the brain learns. In other words, it sees these things, and that's why it recognizes something different and latches onto it.
Well, you know, the brain, it's interesting what they're, in the newer work, we take it a lot further, you know, this whole issue beyond
HARP. Yeah, I can't talk about it because, you know, it's leading into that anyway.
And I guess we're going to have to.
I wanted to get into a new book anyway.
Well, you know,
did you discover something about the brain, the mind? Is that why you got into this new work?
No, actually, it's the outgrowth of what we were doing and interested in well before HARP, and it was more on the side of, you know, brain-enhancing technologies, which is the thing I was interested in, as well as the whole effect of electromagnetic fields and the positive side of what you could be doing. And when we looked at HARP as the largest system ever devised that could, in fact, manipulate behavior, there's a really excellent book. It's called Unless Peace Comes, and in that is a chapter written by J.F. Gordon MacDonald, who was a science advisor to President Johnson when he was in that position, and he was a professor of geophysics at UCLA. And what he said in that book, Unless Peace Comes Back, in 1969, was that if we could ever electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way, we could return a signal that would alter the emotional state of people over huge geographic areas. Now, here, having said that, Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his book Between Two Ages, just before he became national security advisor to Carter, he wrote this book, and he describes exactly the same thing, quoting McDonald. And then you look at HAARP, which can, in fact, deliver on that. We didn't have anything that was big enough to modulate the ionosphere. Now we do, within that exact range that these guys were talking about. Now, as either a deliberate or side effect, that got me really concerned about HAARP in the beginning, was this whole concept that, for instance, for Earth-penetrating tomography, which, like in plain language, would be like X-raying the Earth, one of the applications for HAARP is underground imaging. And when you do this underground imaging, you're operating within a frequency range that happens to be within those same window frequencies of predominant brain activity of humans. In other words, as a side effect of that use, you could have some serious consequences in terms of people over that region. And these are the things that aren't really looked at from the standpoint of HAARP, because they're looking at the ionosphere and they're looking at all of these atmospheric physics applications and weapons applications. But in other departments of the military, they know well and good what exactly these technologies can also be used for. And so that's where we got concerned. And then when we looked at that whole issue of mind-altering technologies, we cite a lot of things within the book Angels Don't Play This HAARP, we were able to find over the last 12 years an additional pile of documents. In total, we used 300 source documents. And the most important thing that we did in contributing to the debate on this is explain the biological or physical mechanism in the first chapters that sort of break down how does this happen, how does this work, and then take and look at the military's development and the patent records and how the science has developed into what state it is today, which we think is the greatest challenge to our consciousness that's ever been mounted against human beings. And secondly,
I was trying to think, in your book you were talking about one of the military applications of this. They thought they could aim this at the enemy.
Right.
Would totally disorient our minds, and it would incapacitate them in that way, and that
right.
was their justification.
Right, and they've and one of the other things that that comes out in all of this is the idea that these weapon systems are being developed to literally with the idea of controlled effects on human beings as biological systems. In fact, the phrase controlled effects was coined by the Electromagnetic Directorate of the Air Force, that published an article in June 2004, and we quoted in our newest book, and this article talked about being able to completely synthesize all of the basic five senses, touch, taste, smell, sight, and hearing, and create full-blown auditory and complete hallucinations. I mean, this kind of technology, as it's advancing, really without any constraint. And the idea here is if you can control the human operator, then it doesn't matter what equipment they might be trying to operate. And the ways in which this thing has exploded. I mean, one of the early quotes we found, and it was in a publication called New World Vistas, Air and Space for the 21st Century. And we first wrote about this back in 2000. And this is what it says. And this is the Science Advisory Board to the Air Force, and it says, it would also appear possible to create high-fidelity speech in the human body, raising the possibility of covert suggestion and psychological direction. Thus, it may be possible to talk to selected adversaries in a fashion that would be most disturbing to them, unquote.
Mm.
No kidding. I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, that's like the proverbial voice in the head, and yeah, that would be pretty disturbing.
It's kind of like that movie, The Manchurian Candidate,
Well, actually, that's not too far-fetched. In fact, that whole concept came from a guy named George Estabrooks, who wrote the first papers on that idea, using hypnosis as the means. He wrote in the 20s, he was working in Harvard's lab on studying hypnosis, and what he found is that 20% of the population could be brought into such a deep hypnotic state that you could literally split the personality. And so he wrote additional papers, and in 1935 his work was classified. We went back and looked at what wasn't classified, and he wrote one of the classics on hypnosis. It's called Hypnotism by George H. Estabrooks, 1943, revised in 47. He wrote another book called Spiritism, which was on spiritual mediums, which he believed was part of this other personality that person could manifest. And then the last book, the most important one he wrote, was The Future of the Human Mind. And what Estabrooks was involved in was many of the earlier experiments run by the Central Intelligence Agency on mind-altering techniques, including LSD. But his main deal was to create that super spy, where you could break the personalities into two parts. One would be totally aware of one, and the other would be totally ignorant of the other. So you could send that one into a country, spend 10 months, they figured, to properly train them, so they'd have a whole life history that was synthesized, and take it out to the public. And that's exactly what they propose to do. And when you think about splitting
a personality... This is what they're working on, in other words.
Yeah, and when you think about splitting a personality, you know, what are you talking about there? It's literally, it's Humpty Dumpty. You can't put a person back together again when you do this. And he believed and professed that this was something that we ought to be involved in. And when you look at all of his literature, it's pretty startling stuff.
Yeah, that says the things you shouldn't be messing around with anyway.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole idea that anyone would consider violating free will, and that's really what we're talking about here, is using techniques to violate free will. One of the other sources we point to is a presidential report from June 1975 that was on, it was actually on the CIA's abuses in this area. And it's called The Report to the President by the Commission on CIA Activities Within the United States. And what they had nailed the CIA for, and this is going to sound like it just happened yesterday, was infiltrating people's mail, infiltrating various groups, tapping people's phone lines, and under MKUltra, described in that presidential report, victimizing 8,000, a minimum of 8,000 servicemen and women under that program who had been used in various experiments. Another recent case, in fact, it came out of Canadian West News Service in Canada on January 11, 2007, and it was related to Ewan Cameron's work when he was doing work for the CIA in Canada. Eventually, you know, the CIA was caught on this one, and they admitted and settled. According to this article, the lady raising this issue in the Canadian courts now was given $66,000 in U.S. compensation by the CIA in 1989 after being used in experiments, in mind control experiments going back to 1958. The other one that just came out...
Well, you know, I've been involved in hypnosis for 40 years, and I know, you know, I do a lot of therapy. But there's one thing I would never do because I'm so protective of people.
Right.
You know, anything like this could be misused very easily.
Absolutely. And you know, it's the ethics of the operator and the people that are interested in getting good therapies. And these can be. It's like any therapy can be misused. And I think that's the important.
That's what I tell them when I have my classes. I always tell them this is not anything to play with. I don't want you to go into it lightly.
Exactly.
Now, here, if you're getting something that could do it to a large group of people in a malevolent way, you know, it's not good. They don't know what they're playing with here.
Exactly. And consciousness itself, I mean, that's the realm we're talking about, which is something, you know, free will is what it's really all about, and that's something that most religions, the Christian religion and every other major religion, says that even God doesn't tamper with, and yet here's human beings without the consent of the person doing exactly that. And I think that's a dangerous, dangerous thing to be allowing to happen. At the same time, these technologies being developed in darkness really ought to be developed in light, where we can properly evaluate them, and those things that have good benefit, that people have the opportunity to access them at their own choice. And we're not seeing that. We're seeing the very opposite kind of thing taking form, where the domain of the mind is as if it's the next marketing program for the next institution. A good example of that came out in the journal Neuron last month, where there was a report done where they were analyzing how the brain operates when it's making purchasing decisions, when it says no and when it says yes. There's very distinct parts of the brain that fire. Well, with that knowledge, as a good example, is you could create a signal, a complex signal, that fired those portions of the brain within a shopping department store, for instance, that made people be more inclined to purchase something. Now, is that good to do? Is that something?
See, that's what I tell people about the commercials. They're aimed at that part of the mind.
Absolutely. In fact,
make people buy. I always mute the commercials on TV.
Well, it's more than just the words. If you look at the flicker rate, and most people who study advertising and advertising psychology know this, if the flicker rate is maintained at a certain level, and you're already in sort of a passive state watching television, that what will happen is the brain will entrain that light flicker, even though you won't perceive it necessarily with the eye, and go into even a deeper state of suggestion, where then just the words that are spoken normally on the ad get absorbed right in as if they were anchored much more factually than they otherwise would be. And for most people who don't mute it, so they catch that message, literally get the same thing as they would have gotten had it been delivered subliminally, only it's not regulated because the technology hasn't gotten, the regulation hasn't gotten caught up with the technology.
Yeah, that's one thing. I always give an example in my class is that people say they can't be hypnotized, and they hooked people up with wires to the television. And they said the TV would only stay on as long as you were in beta, which is a wide awake state.
Right.
If you began to go into an altered state, that the TV would turn off. And people said, oh, I know I'm wide awake when I'm watching TV. Well, nobody could keep the TV on more than 60 seconds.
Yep.
How quickly they would go into the altered state where they could be influenced.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. So what, you know, and here's the other thing that has a lot of people don't even consider. And these are just the simple things. I mean,
yeah, these are the simple ones. You're going into the deep end.
Yeah, the simple ones. Think about when you're fatigued, like most people are when they come home from work and they sit down in front of the TV and catch the 6 o'clock propaganda news. And all the ads that go with it for the rest of the evening, and all of the cultural and social engineering that goes through media anyway. If we all start thinking about all of that, we go, wait, isn't that really shaping us? Are we watching the program or are we the program? You know, and it starts to raise those kinds of questions. And when you look at how technology has evolved and to what state it's finally reached, there's not a lot of time left for having the argument and the debate, in my view. It's gotten to the point where, because we're all literally plugged into the grid in some fashion, the system for doing this is already there, but they're getting even better. There's an article called The Mind Has No Firewalls, and we quote it extensively in our written material U.S. Army War College, and it's under their publication Perimeters. And if you look under Perimeters, I think it's the winter of 98. I might be a little off on the year, but it's called The Mind Has No Firewalls. And it's just a really revealing article in terms of where this technology is at. And here's one of the things it says, and I quote, "A psychotronic generator which produces a powerful electromagnetic emanation capable of being sent through telephone lines, TV, radio networks, supply pipes, and incandescent lamps. This would manipulate the behavior of those in contact with the signal," unquote. Mm-hmm. Now, that's one line basically out of an extensive article, and we quote that again in the book Controlling the Human Mind, our newest one, to illustrate the point that any of these things that carry energy can also carry another signal that has a tremendous effect. Magnetic fields are even more effective, and one of the new systems that people have been, we've been talking about this for years, and they just announced it December 28th last year, was the use of magnetic induction, which was what Tesla was working on for this wireless energy source.
Yes, I remember that.
And and they even cite Tesla in the article. That was so interesting. At this year's electronics show in Las Vegas, it just ended a couple weeks ago, they announced a magnetic induction system that would charge cell phones indefinitely, so you wouldn't need chargers anymore. And but wirelessly, as well as activate RFID tags and anything they're embedded in so that you could then have that signal. But more importantly, that type of magnetic induction system could be submodulated in a way that caused other physiological changes within the body, or even just in its use, because depending on how it's used and where, and this is where the science of communications technicians are not looking at the same things that, say, an electrophysiologist might consider when developing these technologies. And that's, again, why so much more needs to be done in the open light of day and some serious discussion about this whole area of energy interactions or impacts on human beings, and whether and which ones ought to be disallowed and what ones we need to be more sensitive about.
Well, I'm watching the clock, and we've only got about 5 minutes. Can you believe? I have to stop 5 minutes still. Can you believe we've already talked almost an hour? But I do want you to say, well, you know, knowing these things are very important, but is there anything we can do about it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're working on a number of things to try and get more of this information in front of the Congress. My websites can be accessed for helping us in that regard and just getting the material passed on. There's a lot of free articles and material at earthpulse.com, EARTHPULSE, earthpulse.com, and you can look under the mind control button, and there's like 12 or 13 documents and articles. Most of them are government records or they're articles with extensive citations. Pass those on to congressional leaders, senators, let them look at it. I've got an article I wrote with 89 sources there. That gives kind of an abbreviated analysis, and there's a number of government records. So pass those on.
You know, one thing I don't like is now the emails are being flooded with all kind of controversy and all these kind of things, and a lot of it doesn't ring true. So
right.
You know, I don't think a lot of it is real.
That's right. There's a lot of misinformation out there. I think people need to start looking at the source documents and making sure that what they're looking at is legitimate. And that's what we've been careful about. The other site where we are actually posting a lot of our source documents is called thelayinstitute.org, LAYinstitute.org. And it's a site that was funded by Dorothy Lay to help educate the public on the impacts of technology. I'm on the board there, and I also work as executive director for the Institute. And you'll see under EPI search there, a search engine where you can look up keywords like mind control or radio frequency, and you'll see dozens of articles, and you'll get a short narrative on the article and the exact source, so you can go find that original article, or if it's a government record, you might get the whole record there. And there's over 700 documents loaded there now, and there's 20,000 more headed that way over the next couple of years.
Okay, what was that website again?
It's Lay, L-A-Y, Institute.org, and it's got our archive, and we're regularly uploading to that. And the other site with a lot of our articles on the mind control issue is at earthpulse.com.
Yeah, that is yours. And you also have Earth Pulse. It's a publishing company, don't you?
Right. So we have all our books and our videos and publications. We have the we have a video on this subject that we've been covering today. In fact, one on HARP called HARP the Update.
Yeah.
And then we have Mind Control, the video, and then we have Controlling the Human Mind, the book. So there's a lot of material there. People are welcome to go and look at earthpulse.com and get that information, pass it on to others.
Okay, well, if anybody wants to contact you, how can they do it?
Okay, our toll-free number is 888-690-1277. Again, that's 888-690-1277.
Or they can contact you through your website.
Absolutely. At earthpulse.com, just go to info at earthpulse.com, and that'll come over to me.
Okay. But now you have four books. You said you had two other ones, too.
Yeah, Earth Rising, The Revolution, which gets into a mix of technologies. There's over 650 sources cited in that book. It covers everything from the mind control issue, updates on HARP, and a great deal on surveillance and related privacy technologies. And then we did Earth Rising 2, which covers an extensive chapter on cell phones and the risks of cell phones, on the new underwater low-frequency sonars operated by the Navy, another important chapter on personal privacy. And, you know, this is all well-documented material. Between the Earth Rising books, there's over 1,000 source documents between those two titles.
So I think if people do get these emails that come in and they're very questionable, I think the best thing to do would be to contact you or your website to find out if they are legitimate or not.
Yeah, well, you know, we try to respond to those kinds of inquiries as often as we can, and, you know, just look at the sources and, you know, be skeptical. I say that to everyone. You know, if people don't footnote their work and show you where you can find out that information, don't change your life until you see where it came from, because we wouldn't do it in any
other
situation.
That's what I'm always telling people. Don't give your power away to anybody.
That's right. I think, you know, that's the big thing. We each have enough internal power to make change. All of us are doing it in our own way. And that's, you know, that's our biggest encouragement to people is do what we can. We know what we can do, what our spheres of influence are. Let's try and make the world a better place by at least putting out a little bit of effort.
I tell people to think for yourself, ask lots of questions, and then make up your mind.
Absolutely. You know, if our congressman did a little bit more often, maybe we would avoid a lot of the conflicts we're in today.
That's true. Okay, well, I think we're coming up to 5 minutes till. At that time, Don Newsom, who runs this, pulls the plug if I don't get off because he has to bring in the next one.
Well, I appreciate the time this evening, and we'll have to do it again, Dolores.
It's been an honor speaking to you because I know you're like a pioneer, and I greatly respect your work and your research.
Well, thank you so much, and I appreciate hearing that, and I look forward to seeing you out there on the lecture circuit.
And I know I'll run into you again.
Absolutely, we always do.
Okay, and thanks again for being on the show.
Thanks. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. And I think everybody knows my website is Ozark Mountain, OZARKMT.com. And I want to thank everybody for listening tonight, and good night.